I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Francine Prose says the idea for her new novel, Mr. Monkey, began when she took her granddaughter to what turned out to be a rather depressing, amateurish musical. During a quiet interlude, her granddaughter turned to her and asked, "Grandma, are you interested in this?" Everyone in the theater heard the question. Francine Prose lied and said yes. Mr. Monkey is about a terrible off-Broadway musical based on a very popular children's book. The problem is the author hates the musical, and so do the lead actors. Francine Prose has written a very funny book that weaves together the lives and perspectives of those involved with Mr. Monkey the musical and explores ideas about art and creativity, about children and aging, about evolution, climate change, commerce, sex, and love. Francine Prose has written more than 20 books, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here.
So what was it about that question that your granddaughter asked? Grandma, are you interested in this and your lie that got
thinking about this book?
It
wasn't exactly a lie. I mean, I was interested, but I don't think I was interested in the way I was supposed to be interested or in the way that she might have thought. I was interested because it occurred to me that these actors in the play, this children's musical, who can all sing and dance. I mean, they were not untalented, but some of them were close to my age or a little younger. And it seemed clear to me that none of them had ever imagined they would wind up playing. I mean, it wasn't Mr. Monkey. It was another. I made up Mr. Monkey. It was another play that I've, you know, since the beginning been horrified that one of those actual actors might recognize themselves. But anyway, they had dreams of what their careers were going to be, and it wasn't being in Mr. Monkey.
But is that something you identify with, the idea of being an older person and perhaps not doing what you had hoped you were going to do as a younger person?
Oh, it's something I over-identify with. I mean, it's because things can so easily go another way. Things can just not work out, so you wind up, you know, writing copy, telling people how to install their DVDs or whatever. I mean, that could have happened too. So I saw myself in those characters, even though someone else might think I had no reason to, but it seemed to me I did.
Well, I don't think I've ever read anything where you described how to work a computer or something like that.
I wouldn't know how to do it.
You have not done that yet. But do you think that's something about just being a certain age and looking back on your life and, you know, imagining yourself or remembering yourself as a younger person and what you hoped your life would be?
Well, it's that, and it's also the specter of artistic failure. I mean, not only that it's a public thing, but that it's a private thing, that you just, everything you write could just be like acting in Mr. Monkey, you know, that you suddenly realize it's not working. This is not what I had in mind. I plan to do something else.
Have you ever had one of your novels turned into a musical?
I have. The Glorious Ones was made into a musical. And believe me, it was nothing like Mr. Monkey. It was beautiful. I mean, the lyrics were beautiful. The songs were beautiful. It played at Lincoln Center. I wept every time I went to see it. But the correspondence is, you know, is every so often I get this teensy, teensy, teensy royalty check because it's done in some regional theater somewhere. And one of my characters also gets a royalty check, substantially larger,
yes.
I think. But I have had it turned into a musical.
Well, I have to say, when I started reading this, I thought, Curious George, of course, you know, a monkey that's brought back from Africa, lives with a family in New York. And certainly there's some discussion about Curious George in this. In your novel, how much were you playing with that particular story?
It didn't really occur to me. I mean, I knew I wanted a monkey, and then I thought, after a while, you know, somehow when you're writing, the most obvious things only occur to you later. After a while, I thought, oh, yeah, Curious George. So then once I thought about that, I had to make it very clear that this was not Curious George, and several characters have conversations about Curious George as a piece of imperialist propaganda. So I wanted to get that clear.
Well, do you think it's a piece of imperialist
it's
propaganda?
It's not great, okay.
Did you read it to your kids?
No.
No?
It wasn't, you know, I was reading, I mean, I read Maurice Sendak to my kids. I read a lot of things I read Steig to my kids. But Curious George, I just, even then, I had a creepy feeling about it.
Really? Just because the sort of monkey brought from Africa to the U.S.?
Why would you do that to a monkey who was perfectly happy where he was? And think that he would be happier, you know, riding a tricycle and getting into trouble in the United States.
One of your characters, in fact, the playwright, cries every time he goes to the zoo and sees the monkeys in the cages.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they are just a tiny rung below us, if that's even on the evolutionary ladder.
Just a tiny rung.
A tiny
rung.
I mean, sometimes it's not clear how tiny, but yeah, tiny.
Well, not to give too much away, but at the very beginning, you describe what Mr. Monkey, the children's book, what it's about. So, mm-hmm. What is the book about?
Well, it's about a woman from New York who's a primatologist, I guess you could call her, and she goes to Africa to study monkeys. And she gets involved in the situation, which actually happens, where poachers are killing monkeys to basically get the land so they can develop it for oil. And she adopts this little baby monkey whose parents have been killed, and then she herself is killed. So her family back in New York adopts that baby monkey, who becomes the little sibling of the children in New York. And then the monkey, as a kind of party trick, learns how to steal wallets at parties. And then is accused by the evil girlfriend of of really stealing her Hermes wallet and so forth and so on. I mean, that was fun to make up, and it was fun to make up a bad children's musical with the songs and dances and everything.
Do you have songs in your head when that are part of this musical?
I'm still trying.
Is there sheet music somewhere?
I'm still trying to get rid of those songs in my head.
Are you afraid that someone is going to make a musical about Mr. Monkey the Musical?
You know, if I get those little royalty checks, that's okay.
Well, let me have you do a reading. And
sure.
This is Margot, who plays Mr. Monkey's lawyer, if I can put it that way. And she's certainly one of the stars of the play.
Sure. Margot takes 10 more breaths, counting backward, then does her vocal exercises, which her therapist, Dr. Reed, says is a form of Zazen meditation. The oxygen blast reminds her of what she tells herself at moments like this. Give everything. Self-doubt is lethal. Irony is poison. Every role you play with your whole heart and soul can be Ophelia, Juliet, Portia, Lady Macbeth. Well, maybe not Lady Macbeth. The great Carola Lester, Margot's acting teacher at Yale, used to say that it was their job to be theatrical, off and on stage. They must never forget that they are telling the stories of the tribe. Margot was the star, the one for whom the drama department had high hopes, and now she's Portia McBailey representing a monkey. Margot prepared for Mr. Monkey as if for a real play. She'd worked out Portia's background, the successful legal career that has enabled her to take on cases, an innocent monkey for fun. But the purple suit had forced Margot to reimagine Portia as a noble failure, lonely and slightly desperate, but consequently happier to meet and fall in love with Mr. Jimson, an attractive widower with two children.
That's our guest, Francine Prose, reading from her new novel, Mr. Monkey. And the director of this musical puts her in sort of a clownish costume.
He puts her in a rainbow Harpo Marx wig and this tiny little iridescent purple suit that morphs into red. But again, that came from the real production because the actress wasn't wearing a wig. But I could see her costume was falling apart. You could see the kind of the hem had semi-fallen down, and you could see the threads, and it just broke my heart. I mean, I thought, this is a real woman who went backstage and put this on and had to come out into the spotlight.
And for whom, as you write here, people had high hopes,
mm-hmm.
had high hopes that for whatever reason, I mean, we learned some of the reasons, but for whatever reason, it just didn't work out. Have you ever acted you yourself? Have you ever been in a play?
Not since grade school. I was the Angel Gabriel in our grade school Christmas pageant, but only because I was the tallest kid in the class, tallest girl in the class. So, I mean, forget the fact that the Angel Gabriel was actually male, if angels have genders. So I got to do that, but that was the end of my acting, beginning and end of my acting career.
I've interviewed actors who talk about what acting is really being real. It's about not acting. But she and some of the others in this play are forced to pretend to act. I mean, it's one of those really strange mm-hmm. situations, I think, that actors can get themselves stuck in.
Well, they're real actors, and they do what actors... I mean, I've never been an actor, but I've known actors, and it's fun and interesting to hang out with them because they're always watching the way people's little gestures or the way they walk and thinking if they can use that sometime when they're... So these actors in Mr. Monkey have done all that, but then they're doing it in the service of Mr. Monkey, so it's,
right.
you know...
It's complicated.
It's complicated.
This is a funny novel. Is that something new for you, to write funny?
They've, you know, except for the last one, Chameleon Club, they've all been sort of funny. And it's partly, I do it, I write partly to entertain myself. You know, if I'm sitting at the computer and laughing, I think, okay, good day, funny for the writer, funny for the reader, I'm happy. I mean, what's new here for me is I think it's the, I was trying to figure out if this was really true, but it's one of the only books I've written that has a happy ending. And I never, I either have indeterminate endings, you know, that, I mean, I've always thought that, you know, the ending of Chekhov's The Lady with the Pet Dog, the hardest part was still before them, should be a rule, every ending. So I've had indeterminate endings or unhappy endings. But I was shocked when I got near the end and I realized that this was going to be positive, redemptive, and sort of a love story that worked out. I hadn't planned it, but that's how it went.
And that's how writing goes? I mean, I mean, for people that don't write, they feel like, well, you're the writer. You're in control of the story.
I wish. Well, you know, I have friends who have outlines and they know exactly what's going to happen and exactly how long the book is going to be. I don't do that. I've never done that. I write a sentence and then write another sentence. And the reason that each chapter in this book has a different narrator was I would get to the end of the chapter and say, okay, who interested me in the last chapter? And let me see how far I can go with this. So, you know, it starts with Margot and then goes to the child actor who plays the monkey. And then I thought, I'm just going to spin this out as far as I can. So I made a chapter from the grandfather's point of view in the audience, who, of course, is me disguised. You know, all you have to do is change the gender and in theory, nobody recognizes you. And then the grandson. And then my granddaughter, the same granddaughter, told me that one of her teachers, this must have been in kindergarten, came to class and told the kindergarten class, she goes, the teacher says, every night at 11, I take a sleeping pill. And I went, whoops. You know, and I mean, as a someone who teaches myself, I know that there are many occasions on which you say something that you didn't quite mean to say to your class, and then you go, okay, I hope everyone forgets I just said it. So the minute I heard this, I thought, oh, you know what, I want to write a chapter from the teacher's point of view, and then it just kind of spun out. And all I knew was that I wanted to bring it all the way back around to Mr. Monkey, the play. So it spins kind of way out and then comes back.
That's Francine Prose, our guest in this hour of Radio Time. She's been a guest in the past, talking about a number of novels that she's written over the years. Her newest one is called Mr. Monkey, and we are talking about some of the characters, some of the ideas in this book as well. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We'll also have another reading as well. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, again talking with Francine Prose about her new book, Mr. Monkey. It's a madcap story. It's about an off-Broadway production of a very bad musical for kids. Funny, weaving together the lives of the actors, the writer, members of the audience, and touches on a whole bunch of different ideas about things like evolution and aging and art and commerce and children and, yes, and love. Well, let's talk about Adam. He's a teenage boy, and he plays the role of Mr. Monkey in this musical. Anything we need to know about him before reading?
He's 12. He lives with a single stage mom, and he's in the grip of mystifying, unruly hormones. I think that causes him and everyone else a lot of trouble in the production. So this is how his section begins. Danielle asks, "Don't you ever miss the jungle, Mr. Monkey?" The lights go down, and a full moon, pale as lemon ice, rises over the stage. Adam puts his paws over his eyes, inhales swarms of monkey costume dust mites, and, trying not to gag, sings the first notes of his solo, Monkey Moon, a ballad about longing to be a baby chimp again, back in his lost tropical paradise, tossing coconuts back and forth with his murdered monkey, mom and dad. But that's not what Adam wants. He wants to forget the sad film Roger made them watch about the dead wild animals in Africa. He wants his voice not to crack before he finishes this song. He wants to grow taller so he can play something cooler and hotter than a shrimpy orphan chimp. But none of those desires will help him call up the feeling that his mom says he needs for this song. Yearning, she'd said. Yearning, what the hell does that even mean? There's a girl in his building Adam thinks about sometimes, but Mr. Monkey doesn't and wouldn't. And the next 80 minutes are supposed to be about what Mr. Monkey wants. Mr. Monkey wants to be tossing a coconut with his parents.
And again, Francine Prose reading from her new book, her new novel, Mr. Monkey. And you have a great description of Adam, as you said, 12 years old, halfway between boy and animal.
Well, he's wearing a costume. I mean, this is such a low-budget production. He's wearing a costume that the costume department, one person, made from a brown chenille bedspread. And his mother keeps saying, oh, there are mites in there. He's going to develop respiratory problems, et cetera, et cetera.
You gave him a stage mom.
Mm-hmm.
He needed one?
He has one.
That's how it works.
Who knows if anyone needs one?
This is Adam. There's a sentence from Darwin that Adam loves, something about how humans would never have been classified as a separate species if humans hadn't been the ones doing the classification. Is that, I know that's Darwin, it's Adam. Is that you as well?
Well, by the time I'd finished reading as much as I had to read about monkeys to write this, it was me as well.
Just feeling like what we if someone else had been doing the classification, we might have been on par with monkeys or maybe below monkeys?
Well, you know, I think only a few kinds of monkeys treat one another as badly as humans have done historically. So you know, the bonobos, for example, are much more peaceful than humans. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to rate us on qualities such as civility, they might be a little ahead of us.
And Beno, I mean, I'm curious about the books that you had on your shelf about monkeys.
Books about evolution, books about primate biology, books about monkey behavior, books about Darwin, books by Darwin. And they were fun to read and interesting. I mean, of course, the way things go, I can't remember a single thing I read. But at the time, they were very useful.
Because you just can't remember things anymore?
Well, something else has kind of come in and crowded that
exactly.
out.
So. Well, what's interesting in this musical production of the book, they have to take out references to evolution mm-hmm. and other, you know, other, I guess, what, considered to be controversial ideas. Does that often happen, you think?
I think so. And also they're playing to an audience. They're trying to play to the widest possible audience. So heaven forfend they offend anyone in the audience. And they're hoping, of course, that Mr. Monkey has gone national. So they want it to be able to play in theaters all over the country.
Now, the original book is written by a guy named Ray Ortiz. He's a Vietnam vet. Tell us a little bit about him.
He's a Vietnam vet, and he has been suffering from PTSD before that was even a diagnosis, and he knows it. But he's at the very end, there are stories that are going around in his mind that have been haunting him about monkeys in Vietnam. And at the very end, there's a disclosure of what one of those stories is. But nonetheless, he is obsessed by monkeys, and he will every so often go to the Bronx Zoo and just stand there weeping in front of the monkey cage.
And the idea was to write a book about monkeys for adults, but his publisher says, no, there's a more lucrative market.
Right.
It's for children.
Right. And he falls in love with that editor for a while. So he does everything she says, and it turns out she was right, of course, but he's never quite gotten over it.
And kind of feeling like a sellout himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially every time the musical, I mean, he doesn't like the musical for reasons one can hardly blame him. So every time the musical is performed, it opens that wound again.
The idea that he did something for commercial reasons mm-hmm. rather mm-hmm. than for artistic reasons or something about his inner life?
Well, in his original plan, the monkey was going to come from Vietnam and be adopted by Puerto Ricans in New York, which he is. And the editor says, do you want this to be a niche book? That has they have to be adopted by rich white people on the Upper East Side. So everything changed in that way.
Are you saying something about publishing?
I'm saying something about the culture.
The culture of?
of our culture. I mean, commercialism and the idea of pleasing the maximum number of people mm-hmm. and not being political in a way that people might find troublesome.
I'd love to have you read another section. Sure. And this is where we, in a sense, we meet Ray Ortiz.
Whenever Mr. Monkey is produced, which, given how bad it is, still happens surprisingly often, the contract specifies that Ray gets two tickets. He gives the tickets to Mario, his favorite waiter at Enzo's, where Ray spends the royalty checks for the play. Blowing the minuscule theatrical royalties on dinner at Enzo's is a family tradition that all of Ray's wives and girlfriends have liked. Not the checks from his publisher and licensing firms, the Mr. Monkey puppets, the speaking engagements and wise investments from the years when Mr. Monkey was still being optioned for the movies and the option money was still good. Sometimes he senses that a nosy stranger is wondering how Ray manages to live so large on the back of a 25-year-old monkey. The answer is investments, but it's none of anyone's business. Ray has never minded buying and selling houses, moving from one apartment to a fancier apartment, and his luck has been good so far. Knock on wood, Ray says aloud to himself, in the absence of wood to knock on. His money is money from God, working through the mysterious agency of a children's book that has stayed in print, that has been translated into dozens of languages, and which is still being read in classrooms all over the world. Those checks pay the mortgage and the IRS, the grocery and cable bills.
And again, Francine Prose reading from her new book, a novel called Mr. Monkey. So instead of the monkey on his back, he's on the monkey's back, right?
Yeah, a 25-year-old monkey.
A 25-year-old monkey. But this is, he's suffering for his art because his art has been appropriated by somebody else, right?
Well, you know, I mean, as we were talking, Chekhov is all over this book. Margot played Uncle Vanya when she was in drama school and wants to. And Chekhov said, what, that he wrote happy stories for sad people or happy plays for sad people? Well, in a way, I think that's what's happening in the book because it's funny and lively, I hope. And yet there's a kind of sadness hanging over everyone just because that's life, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the young characters want to be old as fast as they can, and the older characters wish they were young again. So all, you know, and the people who aren't in love want love, and the people who have love want more love, and so forth. So all the things that are part of, excuse me, being a human being,
yes,
are in these characters' minds. And I felt that everything I knew about what it's like to be a person, I was just pouring into one character after another.
I was also thinking, because I know you're a writer, that it's also about what it is to be a writer and to have written something and then to see other people take it on, either readers interpreting it in different ways, mm-hmm. or it becomes a movie, if you're lucky, I guess, or a TV show or a musical or a play. And that as the writer, you have to, in a sense, give it up to other people to do with it what they will.
You have no control.
No control.
I mean, a friend of mine years ago, a much older writer friend of mine, said, well, you know, what you're doing is creating a mirror, and people see themselves in it, and all you can do is create the mirror. I mean, in a way, writers are lucky compared, for example, to novelists compared to screenwriters. I mean, the book is the book, but, you know, you write a screenplay, it's like a recipe for lemon cake. I mean, you know,
right?
No one's going to make it the same way. Yeah,
right, right. And just, and they're going to make it their own.
Mm-hmm.
That's happened to you? Or do you, how?
No, I was very fortunate. The only movie they've made, no, this is not true. They made Household Saints out of one of my novels, and I love the movie. And apparently they've made a film out of Blue Angel, but I haven't seen it yet, so I don't know what the story is.
And you loved it because you said, this is still my novel. I still recognize this.
Oh, it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. And every so often I see it. It shows up on TV late at night. And you know, and it's been so long now. I think it came out in, I don't know, 93 or something. You know, it'll take me a few minutes and I'll think, this is really good. What is this? And then I'll think, oh, yeah. It's Household Saints, my novel.
I'm curious because you've written, I think, more than 20 books at this point. Mm-hmm. Does it ever get easier or is there a point in which you become a writer and you kind of know how to do this? Even, of course, dealing with fiction, which takes you into a whole other world.
You're reinventing the wheel every single time. It's never easier. But, you know, but part of the fun and part of the challenge is to do something that's more difficult every time. So, you know, there are things you could do that would be just like things you've done before and just hit that ball straight out of the park. But it's not as interesting. I mean, you want to do something that's harder. And in this case, Mr. Monkey, I didn't even realize this when I started. I wanted to do something that was just closer to the bone for me, that was closer to the heart. So that, I mean, this book is much... no one would ever know how autobiographical it is.
Oh, really?
But I think it is, not because the characters resemble me, et cetera, but because the feelings they have are so close to feelings I've had,
and the feelings of all of 12-year-old Adam, and I mean,
I was 12, right?
Yes, yeah.
I mean, not a boy, but and particularly the grandfather. I mean, that, you know, the one that is most closely. I mean, you know, everyone says, and it's true. I have 4 grandchildren now. Everyone says, and it's true. It's the best thing, and it is the best thing. But in some ways, it's painful, too, because they're not yours. They're not yours. They're not, I mean, everyone says, well, you can give them back, and you don't have to, so forth and so forth. That's true. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, the word yearning keeps showing up through the novel, and there's something about that in that relationship, which is impossible to be satisfied.
And not to be too maudlin here, but I assume having grandchildren also means that you're going to die at some point. I mean, it's the next generation is born, and that means at some point you or grandparents, we're going to disappear. We're going to go away.
Well, funny you should say that, because just last weekend, my 5-year-old granddaughter said to me, you know, when I'm a grown-up, you're not going to be around. She says, you're going to be dead like your mom. And I said, okay, can we pick up my coffin now, or can we just wait a little while? She says, so my mom and dad. I said, what about you? She goes, nah, that's never going to happen.
Oh, there you go. Francine Prose is our guest in this hour of Radio Time. She's got a new novel. It's called Mr. Monkey. That's what we've been talking about. And you're listening to Radio Times right here on WHYY. In fact, the grandfather, I guess, is a bit of a stand-in for you in this novel. The grandfather thinks one consolation of age is desensitization. You worry less about saying the wrong thing. When you were young, you think you'll die from shame, but from time, you'll learn that embarrassment won't kill you. There's another reason why the young despise and fear the elderly. They have no manners, no social sense. They'll say anything, which is so funny because oftentimes that's what older people say about younger people, right? They're so ill-mannered.
Well, there's a scene. I mean, that happens during a scene, which also is based on something I experienced, which was I went to a dinner at my son and daughter-in-law's house, and they're fabulous. I mean, we get along beautifully, but they had all these parents of my granddaughter's friends over. And it was, you know, child culture in Brooklyn. And I'm sure there must be a version in Philadelphia. I mean, it's everywhere, you know, where you were not allowed to talk about anything except the children's schools and what would be the best school and the nurturing school and the progressive school and the this school and the that school. And if I would try to introduce a book or a movie or something like that, they would all look at me, you know, what was I even talking about? Plus, mm-hmm. their sweetly patronizing attitude, like I was some, you know, escapee from the nursing home that had wound up there somehow.
I'm curious about how you did raise your children, since you talk about how your children are raising their children. I assume you and I are probably about the same age, so raising kids in the, 70s?
Yeah, 60s, yeah, yeah. 70s. My kids were born in 78 and 82. I think we were much looser than my children are with their kids. I mean, my grandchildren actually have structures, whereas my own children, they could outlast us no matter what we did. You know, they were more stubborn than we were, and they could, and finally we'd say, you know, whatever.
So give in, right?
Give in. But they're, my kids are quite strict in a good way with their children, and it doesn't seem to have hurt them.
And how were you raised?
I was raised, you know, it skipped a generation. I mean, I was from the generation where my dad would say, what's this A- doing on your report card?
Oh, really? So, wow. Yeah. That's so serious.
That was serious, yeah. But, you know, the jury is still out on how well any of this works or not, right? I did become a fairly high achiever, so, you know, thanks, Dad.
In part to please your dad,
yeah,
you think?
Sure. I'm sure.
Why not? So was this a fun book to write for you?
It was really fun. It was really fun. And it was just, for one thing, because it was funny. And for another, because it just kind of swung along from character to character. And
like
I could
monkey?
Just, like a monkey on the vine, you know, the fake vines in the theater set. And it was constantly surprising me. I mean, when I got to the end, for example, I mean, there are two kind of shocking chapters. I won't give them away near the end, but I went like, whoa, where is this coming from? And then at the very end, the director, Roger, who everyone has just been despising all the way through, I thought, I can't redeem everyone in the novel mm-hmm. and not Roger. I have to give him a heart, really. And so I was able to use all sorts of things that I've been wanting to use in novels for a long time. There's a little story of Tolstoy's that he thinks of that goes in there. And then to give it through Roger this kind of redemptive happy ending. So it was a real joy to write.
Do you think you might be outed in terms of the musical that you saw that became the
no.
inspiration for this
I feel
book.
Fairly comfortable. No one will ever know.
And what does your granddaughter say?
Well, she thinks it's her book, and she's quite right. You know, and she's going, you know, when is the book with the thing I said coming out? Although she does pretend that she was 7 when she said it, and she's 9 now, so that's not humanly possible. I think she was actually about 5 when this happened, but she's very proud.
And the idea, Grandmom, do you find this interesting, right?
No, she's okay with that. But, you know, it's speaking of being older, I do wonder what is going to happen when she gets much older and is able to read the book, because the power of my love for her really is all over this book. So, I can't help wondering how that will affect her.
Well, let's take another short break and we'll get back to our conversation with Francine Prose. She's a novelist and her new book is called Mr. Monkey. We're going to take a short break, get back to our conversation and talk a little bit more about our guest's life and about writing and all the things that are going on in the world. So do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you are just joining us, Francine Prose is our guest, author of a new book called Mr. Monkey, a darkly humorous tale of an off Broadway children's musical about a playfully larcenous pet chimpanzee and other issues as well that we certainly have been talking about. I should add that Francine Prose is former president of Penn American Center and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and she teaches literature at Bard College. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. Something you mentioned earlier, and I saw a couple of years ago, something in the New York Times, you were asked a bunch of questions. One was, do you consider yourself a fiction or nonfiction person? And you said, I consider myself a sentence person.
And I guess I still do.
And well, I wanted to have you expand on that. What does that mean, especially as a writer?
Well, it's so much for me about the writing. I mean, it's more fun to write novels than it is to write nonfiction. It's just more fun. You just make up this whole world and you become someone else and you can inhabit somebody else's skin. But whatever I'm writing, I mean, I'm a person that compulsively rewrites emails. So, you know,
your own emails.
My own emails to people. I mean, not other people.
My
own emails. Because it's all it's important to me that the sentence be clear, that it say exactly what I want to, that I pick the right words. So I'm, you know, a compulsive reviser, everything. You know, now that we're all using computers, right, you lose track of how many. I mean, back in the day when I started and you had 25 stacks of manuscripts on your desk, you knew what you'd done. But I, you know, everything still at this point, I mean, you asked earlier, does it get easier? Everything still probably goes through 50 or 100 drafts before it goes out in the world. Yeah.
Sentence by sentence?
Sentence by sentence.
Wow. And just looking for the right word or what feels right. I assume you know this is going to be fiction, this is going to be nonfiction. Mm-hmm. So it's just a matter of sort of figuring out not just how the words kind of go from there.
Looking for the right word. And also, I think a lot of fiction writers, I write for rhythm as much as I write for anything else. So I do the thing that my grade school teacher said not to do, which is hear the sentence in my head as I'm reading. So I guess, you know, it's like poets, of course, do that, you know, which I hear them over and over. And I think that I'll use the slightly wrong word in the right rhythm rather than the completely right word in the wrong rhythm. So all that's important to me.
Why did she say that?
I think it was supposed to slow you down.
Oh, interesting. Do you work out loud? I mean, are you saying your sentences out loud so you can hear that rhythm?
But I say every word in my head. So it's a kind of, and it's different from reading. You know, when I read, it doesn't work that way. But when I'm reading and revising my own work, I can hear them in that way.
Are you a harsh critic? I mean, clearly, if you're writing a sentence 100 times, is that a harsh critic or just a perfectionistic critic?
Well, one of the things I say to my students is you have to be harder on yourself than anyone else will ever be. And I really believe that. I mean, no one, you know, I never say, oh, no one's going to notice this. I think everyone's going to notice everything, so I'd better fix it.
And this write what you know idea, does that make sense to you for writers?
Well,
the advice often given to writers?
I think you have to use the word know pretty broadly. I mean, do I know what it's like to be a 12-year-old kid in a monkey suit? Not really, but I know what it's like to be 12.
Right.
So again, you're always using something from yourself that you can put into these characters, but the actual circumstances of their lives and their situations, you don't have to have lived it.
Were you a reader as a kid?
Oh, I was a huge reader as a kid. I was an early adopter. I learned when I was like 4.
Really?
Yeah.
You taught yourself?
Well, you know, I can remember learning how to read, which is, speaking of party tricks, I memorized it so I could pretend to read it. And then at some point I went, oh, I'm actually doing this. So, and then I read all the time. And, you know, I like my family. I had a perfectly nice family, but reading, especially when you're a kid, it gives you kind of privacy.
Yes.
And a little bubble, still, a little bubble you can put yourself in and the rest of the world goes away. And that was really important to me and still is.
Would you read in your room, in your bed, with the door shut?
I'd
that
read
kind of
anywhere.
And does...
I mean, there's a family story about traveling across country. I think I was in the 8th grade and I was reading in the back of the car the whole time. And my
You didn't get car sick?
No. I mean, that's one of the great blessings I'm endlessly grateful for. And my father said, don't you want to look at the Grand Canyon? And I looked up from my book and I went, oh, yeah, that's nice, and went right back to my book. So,
oh, wow.
You know, I was in the book.
Did you have friends?
I had friends, yeah.
So you had a balanced life.
I took time off to hang out with my friends, yeah. But they were readers too, so.
Did you think when you were a little girl that you would be a writer? Was that your plan?
I didn't, in a weird way, and I often say this again to my students, there's a funny way in which I didn't know that writers were actual people. I mean, I thought, you know, these books exist. They've always existed. They just pop up like mushrooms on the shelves. And the idea of someone sitting there in front of a blank piece of paper and putting those words down, it took me a long time to kind of figure that out. And I think that's still true. I mean, I think even, you know, my college students think of the book as having come into the world fully made. But that's, of course, not. And one of the things that I do is encourage them to realize the choices were made at every point and to think how much worse this could be if a different word had been chosen or a different thought had been given to the character.
As someone who teaches literature and sounds like writing as well, is it possible to spot a college student that you feel like has some potential or some gifts or has an ability that could make them a writer?
Well, my students send me a one-page paper every week. So by the end of the semester, I've seen 15 pages from them. And so I can pretty much tell. But on the other hand, I don't know, this semester I'm teaching this class called Strange Books, and I've just picked like the 15 strangest books I can think of. So, but the shocking thing this semester, I shouldn't be shocked, is my students, they come into class, they know these texts by heart. I mean, I keep going like, who are you? How do you, because I'll say like, what page is this from? And they'll say, oh yeah, page 243, you know, da, da, da. So it's hugely gratifying to teach them because we can have really interesting conversations. And I feel like I learn something at the end of every class from them. So it's a huge pleasure.
And what are some of these strange books on the reading list?
Well, next week we're doing Jane Bowles' Two Serious Ladies. We're doing Robert Walser's Jakob von Gunten. We did, there are a lot of obscure, you know, we're doing Muriel Spark. It's just one of the least strange ones. We did A High Wind in Jamaica. We did a Shirley Jackson novel, Hangs a Man. Oh. So,
and what's your definition of strange then?
Well, they're not, it's you know, whatever that Supreme Court justice said about pornography. I know it when I see it.
Right.
they're just peculiar, unusual. And many of the writers could be considered outsider. You know, Valser was in a mental institution for the last part of his life. And so Jane Bowles was in an institution. So that, and part of it is my little protest against the idea that writing fiction is a profession. It isn't exactly. I mean, it's not as simple as going to the right MFA program and getting the right agent and, It's a little more complicated than that. And I think by the end of the semester, my students have figured that out.
And is part of the complication just the act of forcing yourself to write or sitting down and making it a part of a ritual?
Yeah, and also the way in which you realize that other forces are at work, that they're not, your subconscious, whatever that is, and it's not, and you can't make it happen in a certain way. You have to wait for things to happen, and the degree to which obsession enters in. I mean, so many of my own obsessions have gone into Mr. Monkey, and that's part of it too. And that's not something you don't learn to be obsessive in an MFA program.
Oh, and since you said it, so what are your obsessions that are in this novel?
Well, art, life, love,
I got
sex,
you.
The list goes on and on.
I read something. It was an interview that you did with Deborah Eisenberg talking about writing in your life. And at one point you said, I'd gone to graduate school and was having a nervous breakdown, although no one even knew, including myself, that's what it was. And I think you were you at Harvard? Or were you falling apart?
Oh, yeah. No, I'd get up in the morning. I had to take German, like beginning German, because I needed, a couple of language for it was a doctoral program. I'd go to an 8 a.m. German language class. I'd come back. I'd get into bed. I'd watch TV for like 8 hours, and then I'd do the same thing the next day. I was not in good shape. And partly it was because I've always loved literature and reading, and I just couldn't connect with the way that it was being talked about. And also, at that time, they've since passed. So I had some real sadists among my professors. And I thought, yeah, I took medieval literature. I was a medieval literature student. And my Chaucer professor, at that point, there were a lot of nuns and priests who took medieval literature for whatever reason. So we would go around the room translating from the Middle English. And whenever we got to like a really dirty part of Chaucer, he'd make the nuns do it. And I'd think, ugh, so what am I doing here? I'm like going to spend the next 6 years being on that side of the table instead of my side of the table. So I was a very happy dropout.
Oh, you did? So you that's it?
I got through 1 year. I think they gave you a master's as sort of like a booby prize along the way. Mm-hmm. I think I got a master's, and then I moved to California, and one of my happiest memories was putting the letter in the mailbox that said I was dropping out. I danced all the way back to my apartment.
And how did your father feel about this? If he,
I think,
or your parents?
Well, by then, actually, I'd had my first novel accepted. I wrote my first novel when I was on leave from graduate school.
So you were in your early 20s?
Yeah.
Wow.
I was in my early 20s. So it wasn't clear that I was going to be able to make a living. I think that was worrisome to them. But on the other hand, I think they didn't, novelist, English professor, I don't think they really cared.
Right. But here you are teaching now, but obviously in a slightly different context.
Yeah,
I guess.
And I love teaching. And also, I teach at Bard, which is a wonderful place. And my academic colleagues are fabulous. I mean, it doesn't always happen that your friends have, that the writers and the academics are friends, but they're so interesting and smart and kind and helpful. So it's really a lovely place to teach.
Francine Prose is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She is a prolific writer with more than 20 books to her name. She just rolled her eyes at me. And that does include fiction, nonfiction novels for young adults. And she has a new novel out called Mr. Monkey. And we have been talking about some of the ideas embedded in this story. And I should add that she was the president of PEN, a literary organization that promotes free expression. She's received a number of prestigious awards for her work. She's speaking tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us, at WHYY Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me read an email from Teresa. I just want to say that I am so grateful to hear Francine Pro's views about Curious George. I'm a children's librarian and can attest to the continued love of all things Curious George. I was not exposed to the book as a child, but as a children's librarian, I remember my first encounter with the original book. Seeing that poor little monkey being stolen from the life he knew and loved seemed so wrong. I hated the book ever since. As a children's librarian, I continued to provide them for my patrons, but only reluctantly.
Go librarians. As I said earlier, I've just written a piece about librarians and the way librarians have been on the front lines with defending free speech and standing up to all the, you know, the attempts by the Patriot Act and so forth to curtail free speech. So they've been out there courageously doing this and I think not getting enough credit. So I couldn't be, you know, and I think every writer has a librarian that we're as grateful to as we are to our early English teachers. So
you had one of those?
Yep. Mrs. Morgan.
Mrs. Morgan. who said, I think, Francine, you would like this?
Yes.
You mentioned the First Amendment, freedom of expression. And I wonder, just this topsy-turvy year of 2016 and presidential politics and all the sort of outrageous things that we have heard on the campaign trail. How are you wrestling with some of the free speech that we're hearing?
It's, you know, the whole thing has been so painful to me and so distracting. And I think I think everyone I know, all my friends and people I work with, that it's like a constant low level irritant that, you know, if I can go for 4 or 5 hours without thinking about it, I think, oh, yay, you know, I've really done something here, but I can't stop thinking about it, and it's very, very frightening. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights are beautiful documents. They're really beautiful. They've always been beautiful, and to have the idea that we could have a candidate who doesn't appreciate those freedoms that are guaranteed is frightening to me.
And I wonder, I mean, who knows how this all will end, but you feel like freedom of expression is on the line to some degree?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, to say, you know, one of the things about a democratic system versus a totalitarian government, one of the things about an election versus a coup is that we don't say that one's opponent is going to be in jail after it's over. I mean, that's something that happens in unfortunate countries where there are these armed takeovers. So that's, you know, the principles of democracy are actually very beautiful, and we need to do everything we can to preserve them.
Are you working on another book?
I'm beginning to think about another book.
Is that how it works?
It takes a long time. I mean, some of the things in Mr. Monkey are things that I've been thinking of for 15 or 20 years and finally have found a way to use. So, yeah.
Well, Francine Prose, has been a great pleasure. Thank you for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty.
You're welcome. And again, the book is called Mr. Monkey, A Novel. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for joining us.